This is Ben Crenshaw. You're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Frank Forster and Mark Horner with the Radio Golf Show. Tonight we have another spectacular guest for you. Joining us from Hartselle, Alabama is Mr. Jim Hartselle, author of the extraordinary book, When Revelation Comes, that we'll talk about today, I'm sure, among other things. Mark, would you please do the honor and introduce our guest this evening?
Of course I will. He's an Alabama native, a husband, father, grandfather, architect, writer, traveler, and I think it's quite safe to say an absolute golf nut and a Lynx fanatic. His stories are regularly printed in two of our favorite magazines, the Scottish Lynx Diary and the Californian Golfer's Journal. Latter's senior editor, Tom Coyne, was recently our guest. He has furthermore published two books. One is about the already legendary modern American cult classic Sweetens Cove, called The Secret Home of Golf. His other book, When Revelation Comes, describes his travels through Scotland shortly after the sudden death of his son, Jordan. In this book, the author leads the reader over the fabled links of Ayrshire and up the east coast to Brora, Dornoch and Cruden Bay, and further on to Durness in the very north. He takes us to legendary Prestwick, to Pamure, North Berwick, and to many more. In the end, he returns to his beloved Dunerberty, his, I'd call it, home course away from home, and to the fantastic Machahanish Golf Club. Along the way, he meets and portrays the everyday people, players, clubhouse stewards, and greenkeepers who make our game so brilliant, so lovable, and so great. But his book is far more than a written record of a golf trip. And even though in its center it's about the worst loss I can imagine, it's also a true love letter to life, to the magic and poetry every chance encounter can hold for us, and to the beauty of it all. Sorry about that. When Revelation Comes is thus exactly our kind of book. And I must say, probably my favorite book of last year. Needless to say, how excited we are that Jim Hartselle, after accepting our invitation some very, very long months ago, has found the time to come to the Golf Show. Jim, welcome. I do not know where to start. Frank, would you mind?
Would I mind? I would not mind at all. I'm probably not the only one who starts reading books from the back. And so I did with this book. I like to start with the bibliography. And when I saw the bibliography to this book, Bamberger, Darwin, Umberto Eco, Michael Murphy, I said, this is going to be my kind of book. But it didn't stop there, because leading off the bibliography is a quotation that goes, "You only have to read the lines of scribbly black and everything shines," which is a
I like that one.
Line written by Syd Barrett to the Pink Floyd song Matilda Mother from their debut album Pipers at the Gates of Dawn. And it reflects Barrett's common theme of nostalgia for childhood and the awareness that it could not be regained. I just found that absolutely fascinating. And then if you keep turning towards the front of the book, the next thing you see is a list of the top 100 courses. But I do want to start here, Jim, if I may. Bobby Jones once said, "Don't worry about par. The practice of printing par figures on a scorecard is literally a mental hazard." And you talk about this in your book. How is par? What is par? Is par important?
Well, first of all, if I've got two Syd Barrett era Pink Floyd fans on here, we're going to get along pretty well. That's probably my favorite musician of all time. But Parr, I think I talk about it here and there in the book. And Scotland is a place, and Lynx Golf in particular, where it's really sort of irrelevant, which is one thing that I really love about it. And you'll see in that top 100 holes that I listed, some people have laughed at me. There's a par five that's 350 yards, and there's par fours that are 240 and 250 and 260. There's, it's funny at Dunaverty. I joke about this a lot, but there are par threes at Dunaverty that are much harder than the par fours. I mean, you make a four on number six at Dunaverty, or you really think you've done something. And it's a par three, and the hole before is shorter, and it's a par four. So, to me, it really is sort of irrelevant. It really, I enjoy the shots, and I enjoy match play. I mean, I like to shoot a good score just like anybody else, but it doesn't really, several years ago, it just hit me that, worrying about the score to the point of obsession is just, it takes a lot of the fun away from golf. And so that's kind of, I think you need par because, it's fun to stand up there and say, okay, this is a par three, a par four, a par five. It's fun to say you made an eagle, even if it is a 350 yard par five. But I don't think it has, at least in my mind, it doesn't have much to do with it because it's the same thing with yardage. I mean, yardage is totally irrelevant in my opinion. I mean, I'll go back to Dunaverty, but a lot of these courses I list, I think Dunaverty's 4,700 yards. And what difference does that make? Because it's still, I've played in competitions there. You play the course when the wind's up or the, it you still have to, this, everybody still has to play the same course. So I just don't, at least outside of the pro game, I just don't see much, it doesn't hold a lot of relevancy for me.
I think you mentioned that what's important is getting it into the hole in fewer strokes than your opponent.
Exactly.
So
Yeah.
I
And
find that.
that's still in the UK especially, and I don't know how it is in Germany, but that the match is still is what is valued above just about anything else. I mean, if you're going to post a score, it's usually almost always a competition, which they have those, and that's fun too. But that the scoring is sort of saved for that, an open competition or something, and the match is what's important.
Right. Now this list of 100 your 100 favorite holes in Scotland, and I mentioned in either the last podcast or the one before that my folks lived in Scotland when I was in college, and I used to go there in the summers, and I've played like three of these courses. I don't know
Wow.
who it was. I think it was maybe with Coyne when I said this. But what's fascinating to me is that your criteria to pick these 100 holes, it's a mixture of fun, natural beauty, strategy, quirkiness, and other intangible factors that are not explainable. I mean,
That's the easy way out, isn't it, Jim?
yeah, but you can't
Very
say it better
easy way
than that.
out. Yeah, okay. I can't explain it.
Well, it's I laughed when I wrote that line, but I knew that. By listing these things, lists are kind of, they're so subjective, and we all enjoy these rankings that come on and the top 100 courses and everything. It's fun, but it's so subjective, and I can't explain, there's just so many, there's something about the fourth hole at Dunaverty that I just think about all the time. And coming over that dune and seeing that the green kind of sunk down in this punch bowl. I don't know. I mean, I know that's kind of a catch-all to put that phrase in there, but it really is kind of true. I don't, sometimes I can't explain why I love a hole so much. And so it was kind of a, it was an interesting, I'm glad I did it now, because it, a lot of people have enjoyed it. 'Cause as you say, a lot of these courses are not, they're not on the top list of when people are coming over for 2 weeks or whatever
Right.
they,
Right. Yeah, it's how did this start for you with Scotland? Can you maybe talk to us about or tell us about your first experience there and what pulled you there?
Yeah, it's my dad. He's a big golfer. He still plays once a week. He's 79, and
Featured in the book, yeah,
yeah. And so I've just golf has just been what my family has always done. Both my grandfathers played, and it's what we did on weekends and on holidays and so forth. And so, but you know. The Open Championship, I just became fascinated with it. My dad loved the tournament, and you guys can probably remember, it back then when I was a kid. They didn't show you didn't get to see these courses all the time. I mean, you didn't have the internet, and you didn't. I mean, you might see them in the back of a magazine somewhere, or in Golf Digest or Golf Monthly, but you didn't, and you only got to see a few of the holes. I mean, the coverage was on the weekend, and it would start on the 12th hole or something. But I just remember starting probably about the time that I remember the time I was young, but I remember when Watson won at Carnoustie against Jack Newton, and Newton, they went to a playoff, I believe. And I remember
77
what that was 75.
or 75.
Yeah, and I remember watching that a little bit, and just sort of my dad loved the tournament. And then I remember the next year, Johnny Miller won at Birkdale, and it was, I think, Seve came on the scene. And I clearly remember watching Seve in that tournament. And
Was that the one he hit from the car park?
I don't
Or was
think
that?
that might have been the car park. I
I think
thought
it
the
was the
car
car
park.
park thingy,
I thought
wasn't
the
it?
car park was at Lytham, I
Yeah, I
think.
thought I think that's Lytham, yeah.
Yeah. But he played that year, and he was very young, and he made a crazy shot at the end. I remember him making a crazy shot on the last hole, and just an impossible shot. And anyway, but the next year is what really hooked me in. I remember watching almost that entire, well, I know we watched the entire weekend, my dad and I, at 77. And you guys know, I mean, it's probably the most famous tournament of all time. Watson and Nicholas, and it just, to this day, I'll go back and watch that last round every once in a while. It's just, but the course fascinated me, guys. It was, you can look at these old videos, and it was completely burnt out, and the ball was rolling forever, and I don't know. I just remember thinking, this is something that looks like the way golf should be played, and I just became fascinated with it, and I bought every. Started buying books at a young age, and magazines, whatever I could get my hands on, and really just started. So yeah, the Open Championship is kind of what started it, and then it just went from there, and I just became fascinated by it. Because as you guys know, I mean, it's not links golf is different than just about it what it's unique. It's not like what I would consider regular golf. It's a different game, and a lot of it has to do with the geography, obviously, and the conditions and the turf, and I don't know. There's just something about it that's that I've always loved and have can love my entire life.
What's the greatest difference you would make, you would see between links golf and golf as it's played, let's say in Alabama? The most singular difference.
I think it's the strategy and the ability you have to play whatever shot you really want to play on a links course. I mean, you could hit a 100-yard hook or a slot, a cut, or hit the ball into the wind, or hit it on the ground, or play it in the air.
You can pass it from 100 yards
You can
in.
putt it. You putt it from 100 yards. I mean, I've putted from 150 yards at Denavity. I mean, it's just you could never do that here. Because of the conditions. I mean, now there's a few places where, we have sort of sandy conditions, and it plays a little bit like that. But just the ability to play different shots and use your imagination, I think, I think the players a lot of times that play well, their mind just opens up, I think, when they get to these places, because the possibilities are just so limitless when you play a links course. You can really just hit just about any shot you want, and to me, that's the biggest difference.
And this weekend we saw the opposite on Pete Dye's TPC at Sawgrass. I mean, which was manufactured from a swamp and has nothing to do with the landscape.
It does not. And but it was fun to watch. And I think the courses like that are good for pro golf. And it's funny if you go back and look at some of the photos from when TPC first opened, it played a lot different back then. I think that Pete Dye intended for it to play hard and fast, and it just they got away from it over the years. I mean, you go back and look at there's not as many trees. I think it kind of developed into something that, which is fine. I don't have a problem with it, but I think it developed into something that maybe is not 100% what he intended it to be, if I could say that. I mean, but yeah, it's completely different. The ball, and you see what happens when these guys can, when there's a little bit of
Yeah.
the green, when the greens are wet, it's just a, the guy shot 62 Saturday, and you just can't stop these guys when the ball doesn't roll. I mean, there's just
Absolutely,
no
but when
way.
there's a little wind, you know.
Wind and hot, fast conditions make it fun, which that's why the Open to me is the most fun tournament to watch. It just it wasn't. I mean, think back to Muirfield a few years ago when Mickelson won it. The ball just never would stop rolling, and that. That to me is what I know. I know it's difficult to get those conditions in some places. It's impossible. But the more it's like that, the more fun it is, at least for me to watch.
Right.
But we were actually, you were talking about the, how it began with watching the Open, and but when was the first time you went over? Because I remember you went over, I think, at least once with your father in 94, I believe
Yeah,
it was.
we made several. I made four trips with my dad, and the first one was in '94. We had talked about going for years, going back all the way to that first when we watched the Open. I remember him saying we were going to do it someday, and I had just gotten out of college, and he said, and I had just read, and you'll appreciate this, both of you will. I had just read To the Lynx Land by Michael Bamberger, which is a classic, one of the best books about golf that's been written. And I just brought it up to my dad, and I said, we need to do this. And he's like, okay,
Yeah.
let's go. You set it up. The only thing I want to do is I want to play Carnoustie and the Old Course. He said, the rest of it, I do not care. We can go wherever you want. So I set that trip up, and we went to Mackerhannish for a week, which was unheard of back then. And I honestly did it, Mark, strictly based
Of
off
the
of
book.
Bamberger's book,
Yeah.
100%. I mean, I had never, I have to say this. I mean, I'd never really heard of Mackerhannish. I mean, I guess I'd seen it in some of the magazines I'd bought and so forth. But his book was the first time I really knew anything about it. And,
I think the people of Mackerhannish will be putting up a statue when Bamberger dies. I'm absolutely sure because you're not the first person to tell me that he just went there because of Bamberger. And I can tell you, my first golf trip to Scotland, I think 2000 and something, was basically as you did it. We grabbed Bamberger's book. We went down the list of courses, and we picked the most fantastic descriptions. And I think it was Mackerhannish. And we went there and played. We went down to Dunaverty, played there. It's like a blueprint of how could you call it, of the modern golf traveler, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I have to admit, I mean, we went to Cruden Bay on that trip. We went to
Yeah.
Dornoch. We did the stuff that he where he went. And now And I actually, I've mentioned this on another once or twice, but I actually called him and talked to him. He was a young guy. He was a writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And I got the, this was before the internet and stuff. I found the number, called, got him on the phone. He was so helpful. He probably thought some, you know, he couldn't believe somebody was calling him about it, I'm sure. But, you know, I found Dinavrity on that trip, and it's a part of the story in the book. You know, I didn't know anything about Dinavrity, and that's one thing I love about doing these trips, the way that I've been able to do them, is just letting you planning stuff, but leaving room for things to happen, like going to Dinavrity, which I had never heard of in my life, and I fell in love with on that trip. And, you know, meeting somebody and them saying, well, you know, you really should play Caradale while you're down here. You know, you'll love it. And almost without fail, those recommendations turn out to be great. And so that's kind of how I found some of these places. I have to give that book credit. You know, I don't know how many copies of that thing I've given away over the years. And, you know, I have to say that it inspired me in my writing as well. And that's one thing I hope from this book. I mean, you know, this book is obviously got a tragic story in it, but I wanted it to be a love letter to Scotland and Scottish golf and the type of golf that I really love over there, which is sort of off the beaten path. I love it all. Look, I'd play the Old Course every day if I was able to. I mean, who wouldn't do that? But I mean, I like going to these places, you know, like Askernish and Dinavrity, which has kind of become my, just kind of a home course for me, that I feel like I have to go every year and stay a few days. So yeah, it's, that was the one that did it for me. And then of course, after that, I already had a lot of golf books by that point, but, so we started in 94, and then we just started going every couple of years for several years. And, you know, I joined Macrahanish that first trip. I joined it as they had a classification of member called a country member back then.
Yeah.
And I had that for about 10 or 15 years, and I gave it up. And then now I'm a member at Dinavrity, which is great. So, I don't know that book just opened a world to me that I had never really thought about before. And it's a way to travel too. I think that, again, that I tried to sort of, you know, pay tribute to in this book, you know, the way that I've done things and, you know, taking the time to observe. And I think you guys mentioned it a few minutes ago, you know, observing the interactions that you have with people or, you know, places that you go, to me, that's half the fun of it. I mean, I love golf and I love being out on a golf course, but I just as much love the people that I've met on these trips, to be honest.
I think it's, you know, especially when you say, like, you're down there and there's people saying, well, if you're already down here, you have to play this course and you have to play this course, especially because basically everyone plays there. So everyone will have a favorite course and you will always be getting all these recommendations. And most of them are brilliant. But I can very much connect to what you're saying, especially about golf and the people. I think basically what golf, especially in Scotland, is about is the interaction with others, the mutual joy, the love for the game, and that comes across. It's brilliantly told in your story. I can very much relate to most of it.
Yeah, I mean, is there anything more fun than, you know, going into the clubhouse or the pub after a round in Scotland and talking? People always want to know what you thought about the course. They don't really care what you shot. I mean, if you hit a good shot or you had a good hole, they might be interested in that. But they really want to know, what do you think about the course? How'd you get on? How'd the match go? I mean, I love that. And I love that people are so proud of their golf courses. I mean, when we played Askernish last year with my friend Robbie, you know, we sat in their little clubhouse with There was four or five members sitting in there. It was a terrible, the weather was terrible that day, and they were just sitting in there having a pint. And we wound up talking to them for an hour about the golf course and, you know, what holes we liked. And, you know, that to me, you know, is the fun of golf, is the, you know, talking about, you know, that part of it. And, you know, not necessarily what you shot, but what you loved about the course. And
there's a generosity in it, isn't there? There's a generosity in wanting to share and not wanting to keep. Even I've found that even in the most private places, you'll always be welcome to share the course. There's nothing like, you know, in top Australian courses where you're going to have to beg to be let on. There's more pride in sharing than there is pride in protecting.
I love that. And that, you know, that's kind of a theme of my book, because I just, you know, it's different in most other parts of the world. I mean, the U.S. is just loaded with golf courses, and, you know, and a lot of great ones. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, if somebody invited me to play Cypress Point or Shinnecock, I'm sure I would go, but it's not, I don't imagine, at least I could be wrong about this, but I don't imagine the members at Cypress Point and Shinnecock asking a visitor what they thought about the golf course, you know, when they come off, if they would even speak to them. So that's, you know, it's a community thing in Scotland. And I love, as much as I love the Carnoustie and the Old and Muirfield and, you know, Froon and these brilliant golf courses, and Turnberry, you know, but I love the smaller ones, and I love the community aspect of it.
I think that's an excellent conversation you guys just had, because I mean, we've all been to Scotland and, you know, spent a lot of time there, and it's always difficult to verbalize to people who have never been there what really makes it so brilliant. And I think you know, just that how proud members are of their golf course. You know, I remember when my folks lived there, we were members at Royal Burgess in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't really, you know, it wasn't a links course, obviously, but it was still Scotland. You know, it was still, the people still had the same kind of attitude. How could we, or how could you, because I'm not a literary critic or a cunning linguist, how could we describe the golf courses of Scotland? What makes them brilliant to somebody who's never been there?
I think there is a naturalness to the courses that is just, I mean, you come to some of these places, like Askernish or Dunaverty or Macrahanish, and you just imagine, Old Tom or James Braid. You know, Brora, a course that I love, is a great example. I mean, you walk out to Brora and,
the cows and the sheep.
The cow, yeah, it's, you know, and I'm writing a story for Link's Diary about Brora right now, and I've been fascinated. I've loved it all these years, but it's, you know, the fact that it's the crofting rights or the farming rights have never been, the those have been left intact for 150 years or whatever, and you go out and play this golf course amongst Highland cattle and sheep, and it's so natural. It looks as if, you know, Braid walked out there and said, okay, here's a hole. Let me find 18 greens and we've got it. And let me find 18 tees. And, so I think the natural, you know, nature of these places, I mean, you think about, Mark, you mentioned Macrahanish a couple of times. You think about the third through the eighth hole at Macrahanish. I mean, can you imagine a more natural setting for golf in the world? I personally can't. You know, it's just amazing. And it, you know, you can't, even though there's some great architects out there, and I, you know, that can create some things that look like they've been there for 100 years, and, you know, and that's a talent too. You still, when you see it, like, in its natural state, like you see in Scotland, and this goes for the inland courses too, not just the links courses. I mean, I love the inland courses as well, they're just so natural. It's like the landscape is there, and we don't want to mess it up. We've put a golf course here, and if there's a hill in the way, so be it. If there's 18 blind shots, so be it. That's just the way it is. So.
If I think what you're basically knocking on is the idea of belonging. I think it belongs there. It's you just mentioned Brora and Bray going up there to design it, and I read at least one story that he went up there in the morning with a train. Walked the course, defined 18 holes, and was back in the evening, and took a few shillings for his work. And I think that's what you're pointing at, is that these guys used to go out without machinery, without without any technology of, clearing trees. Well, they could, could hack a few things down, but they would basically find holes and not design them. So a friend of mine who's 90 and lives in Montrose, and is a philosopher and a humble Catholic too, he will always say that basically God designed these courses, that they've always been there, and we've tapped in and started playing them,
No, I agree
which
with
is
that.
for me something strange because I'm a non-believer. But there is a certain it's easier to describe golf in Scotland if you're a religious person.
Well, and I agree with the underlying sentiment of that because Old Tom and Braid and these guys, Willie Park and they did just drive up or come up on the train, or in Tom's case, come over on a boat and walk the site and stake out a few places, and then they're gone. And I think there's a value to me in the world such as it is right now, where technology is so prevalent and the world is so smaller in terms of you can do everything on your phone. And I mean, I'm not saying anything that's earth shattering here, but to go to these places that are unchanged over the last 150 years, and people are perfectly happy that they're like that, there's some value in that. And I'll tell this story real quick, and I think it's in the book. I know it is. I was at Shishkin, which I've been several times over the years on that first trip. That's another story, played Shishkin. But I was there, and I've gotten to know the pro a little bit, Doogie Bell, and I'd played all day, and I was walking out, and I was about to leave and go back over to the mainland, and he stopped me, and he said, and I don't know why he asked me this, but I was walking out the door, and he said, "Jim," he said, "I just want to ask you something." He said, would you change anything about this golf course?" Which, a lot of your listeners will know is a 12-hole golf course and just a brilliant place, one of my favorites. And I said jokingly, I said, "Doogie, if you guys ever change a single thing about this place, I'm calling the police." And he got a good laugh out of it. But I think, and in subsequent trips, I've talked to him about that, and he said, occasionally we get members saying, "Well, what if we did this or did that? And what if we added a something here or there?" And I don't know. I think there's a value to things that don't change over time. And playing something that, Walter Hagen or Willie Park or the park, who knows, played. It just, to me, there's a value to that in the world. That there's still places like that.
You mentioned also at some point that, talking about the golf courses again, when did blind shots become unfair? I always thought those were, so much fun because, and now people, when they have a blind shot, "Oh, did you see that hole with the blind shot? What is that? Who did, what's going on there?"
Well, I think you'll find from my list of 100 holes that I don't know off the top of my head, but I bet half of them have blind shots.
Yes.
At least half have blind shot. And I think I personally blame it on, and this is a debate for another time, but the golf course architecture of the 50s and 60s, when it became sort of fashionable to design courses for the professional game as opposed to for fun and for and courses and people just started talking about what's fair and what's not fair. I mean, it drives me nuts when I'm watching golf on the weekend, the PGA, and they talk about, well, he's got a good lie in a bunker, or this is a perfect bunker, or this you're not supposed to have a good lie in a bunker. When did it become, when did, why did it become that pros had to have a good lie in a bunker, or they had to have a good lie, on the side off the green? I mean, it just, I don't know. So a lot of that I blame personally on, the way that architecture went for the longest time, really up until the 90s, until Crenshaw and some of these people started looking at it a little bit differently, and not as corporate oriented and PGA oriented. That's just my opinion.
Didn't
But it's
and,
strange, isn't it, that, sorry.
go ahead.
It's strange, isn't it, that these corporate orientated courses, as you've just called them, they have taken a lot of fun out of the game, haven't they?
They have, and I don't mind saying it. I mean, I don't enjoy going to these Florida resort courses. I won't go to them. I mean, and I have no problem with people that like that, because golf, you can enjoy golf in a lot of different ways. I mean, there's people that love that kind of golf and, having water on 17 holes and every shot and, out of bounds. You go, the ball goes over the cart path and it's out of bounds. I mean, that's, if people like that's fine. I personally don't. I like something a little bit different. And, a lot of these courses that I enjoy, people probably think I'm a lunatic. Colonsay and Iona and
Colin.
Cullen. I mean, Cullen is a nut house. I mean, think about it. I mean, it's, but I love it though. I mean, nobody would ever design something like that today. But I defy you, Mark, to play that place and not just be laughing the entire time that you're there. I mean, if you can't have fun doing that, I mean, you need to do something else. I
Right,
mean,
you can't have fun in Cullen. You're a grumpy old fart.
you are. So, and again, I just to finish off the I don't have anything against, these other, these kind of resort and, courses that we have around the US. That's all well and good. I just personally don't have as have much fun. That's why I've enjoyed Sweetens Cove so much the last few years, is it's kind of the opposite of that. And so when I play around here, that's where I play, nine times out of 10. And then I just wait for my 2 weeks a year that I can get over to Scotland and just play as much as I can. So, and look, I like going out here. If I, there's, if I, I'll go out with my dad and stuff and play. I don't mean to sound that because I'm not arrogant about golf and where you, people like what they like. And, I don't personally like courses that are a lot of what we have here, but that's just me. So.
Can I ask another question about architecture?
Yes.
There's right next to Machahanish, right next to the Machahanish Golf Club, there's Machahanish Dunes, a course that I thought was strangely, sorry, this isn't a critique, but that's strangely under. It could have taken a role in your book, and I thought it might. And it's like a footnote, especially after what you just said. It is basically exactly what we were talking about. They picked the holes out of the land. They didn't change much. It is something very, very genuine. And I was sort of missing it. I would have really, really loved your opinion on that.
Well, I have played Macrohanish Dunes, and I actually probably owe it another chance. I played it on a day where I was with my son Jake, and this was before the trip that's in the book. And it was so hard, Mark. I mean, we could not reach the fairway on several holes, and it just became. Now, look, don't get me wrong. It's got some of the most beautiful holes that I've ever seen, and I'm not against the course at all. I pull for it. I hope it does well, and I need to play it again because sometimes when you play a place once and it's just you get blown away by the conditions. I remember I played Lahinch with my dad in Ireland, and we showed up. And I'd been wanting to play Lahinch for 15 years, and as long, and we showed up, and it was just a hurricane. There was nobody there. There was one guy in the pro shop, and I said, I actually asked the gentleman if we could get our money back, and he kind of laughed at me. He said, no, we don't do that. And I said, well, I guess we're going out then. And we were the only two people on that entire golf course, and it was sideways rain. And I remember two of the holes, I think it was just so bad. Now I'm glad I did it, and but I, again, it's, I think sometimes you get, if you only play a place once and you get hit by a terrible weather conditions, it can kind of be unfair to the course because you don't. And so that's my, I have nothing against the course, and I played it the day we played it. We had a wonderful time because we did play a match with the a couple of guys from Campbelltown, and we had a wonderful the match and it, that part of it, I should probably say we had a wonderful time because the match wound up all square, and if you made a 10, it didn't matter. You could just pick up and, but I will tell you that course is, I've I can't imagine trying to. I think we played the regular tees, and it was I can't imagine playing the back tees there. But look, it's
Go
some of
back.
the.
Go
It,
back
it,
again.
I'm gonna give it another shot
Yeah,
because
please do.
I know a lot of people that play there and they like it, and I know they're talking about building another course there, which I think is
Again,
great
a
if they do
third
it.
course.
Yeah, they're talking
Oh,
about
that would be
building
nice.
I forget what they're calling it, but next to Macrohanish Dunes. So look, it's my favorite area, and I'm a fan of the people there, and I just need to. I need to give it another chance. So that's a kind of a long answer, but that's, and then on that trip in the book, it just worked out. I was staying at Dunaverty and playing mostly at Dunaverty, and I did play Macrohanish, but it just never, I never, we had a competition at Macrohanish, and it just didn't work out. But
No,
I'm not.
I can totally relate that you're there in Dunverty, and you're going like, well, this is my course. This is where I want to play. There's these other two brilliant courses down the road, but I can't really bother going because I love this place so much. I just wanted to clarify that because I was wondering, because it is such a special course.
It is, and I've got some of my photos from that trip. Some of my best photos are from Macrohanish Dunes. I mean, it's really, some of the holes just sit there, and you just think this is perfect. But I owe it another chance. I just got it on a day where it was so hard that it was demoralizing. But
Yeah,
anyway.
I played there with a friend in a storm, and he says he will never return, never, ever, ever again, never again. He hated it. He really, really hated
Well,
it.
it's if you get it in the wind, the really, how the wind blows down at Macrohanish. I mean, especially, I can't remember, but it seemed like with the first, it seemed like whatever direction we turned, the wind was in our face, and which is, I don't know how that happened, but I remember, even so, I remember some of the holes. I remember the par three, five or six, I think it is, and 17 and 18, I clearly remember, and so I have nothing against the course. I
Right.
just,
Okay.
yeah,
Just wanted
yeah,
to clarify.
yeah, yeah.
Sorry about that.
It's all right.
Frank.
Yeah. Quick nine.
Shall we? What do you think? Anything you would like to get rid of before we do that? Or Jim, okay. So this is the quick nine, mostly never nine. Not always quick. Okay. What's the most valuable golf tip you have ever been given?
You have to hit a putt in the middle of the putter face or it won't go in. From Robbie Wilson.
That's a good one. A bit of a tricky one, this one. Who would you like to play your last round with? You can choose from anyone, living, dead, or whatever. Pro.
Well, it would be Jordan and my boys and my dad. I played with my dad for, 45 years now, and I got to play several rounds with all three of my boys, and we just always had a really good time, and so that's who it would be.
We'll get back to that, to family golf, I think. What golf book would you advise a novice to read if he would like to fall in love with the game?
Oh, that's such a good question. I'm sitting here staring at about 500 golf books. Gosh, that's a hard question. Probably To the Links Land.
That thing is turning into a number one hit on the golf show. Because I think Tom Coyne it was, wasn't he? Tom said he would strongly advise every novice to read that, I think.
Yeah, that would be it for me too. Yeah.
All right. Against all odds, you have won, let's say, the Alabama State Senior thingy, okay? Tournament. All right. You and your mates decide to celebrate at a karaoke club. What's the first song you'll sing? And how will you close the night?
Oh.
This is the question you will answer.
I will answer. the first song would be, well, let me go backwards. I'd close the night with Roadhouse Blues by The Doors.
Ooh.
We haven't had The Doors yet, haven't we, Frank?
Because by that point, everybody should be well into their pints, and that's kind of a good one to end with. To start with, oh my goodness, probably something by Lucinda Williams, maybe Jackson.
Oh, I love Lucinda.
Yeah. That'd be a little bit earlier in the evening when everybody's still kind of calm.
Jackson
is.
If you could change one rule, what would it be?
In golf, I think it would be probably the out of bounds stroke and distance. I'd probably get rid of that one. I mean, most people play with their mates and their friends by just,
drop it up there.
Yeah.
You're not one for taking the ball out of a divot on the fairway, are you?
No.
As it lies. Yeah,
I like to play it as it lies, but I do, and I know that's kind of at odds with the stroke and distance, but I just, and I think even at some point in the history, somebody can do some research on this, but at some point in the history of the RNA and the USGA, that got changed for a little bit, and then it got changed back. That's the one that I would change. But I do think people should play out of divots. Most of the rules I agree with. I noticed that there's some big announcement coming apparently from the RNA and the USGA. People are speculating on the ball and the clubs and stuff, but I think normal people like us should be able to play with whatever they want, but if they want to change some stuff for the pros, that's fine with me.
How is the Hartzell game at the moment?
I've got a lot of work to do before the Scotland trip. I've played a couple of times, but I've been doing a good bit of writing and working on promoting this book, and I'm hoping to. I'm playing in a competition with Robbie at Denaverty, and I want to be. He's a good player, and I want to help him a little bit if I can. And so I'm going to work on it. It's yeah. My game does not take a lot of maintenance. I can still play okay. You know, for not like I could, you know, like most people, like I could 30 years ago. But I, you know, but I'll start here. Really, probably this weekend. You know, working on some, because you know. The shots you need in Scotland are the sort of that punchy 8-iron from 100 yards, and so I'll work on some of that stuff.
Do you have an off season in Alabama?
Not really. I mean, this time of year we're starting to come out of the worst weather. I mean, I'd say from January, February is when it's really bad here. But even then, you know, you can play. You can play year round, but that it's a bit sketchy. We're starting to come out of the worst weather now. It's really kind of getting nicer, but it rains a lot. January, February, it rains. I mean, it wouldn't be strange for it to rain on every day. I mean, it just so, and that so that that's kind of the worst time of the year.
What's your game like, Frank, at the moment?
My game is sharp.
It's sharp, cold, and sharp.
Absolutely,
cold and sharp.
Got the carpet swings going. I remember Alabama from when Trevino won the PGA at Shoal Creek. That's my first experience. Well, other than the Neil Young song, that was my first experience with Alabama.
I went to all four rounds of that. I was in high school, and I followed. I was a big Nicklaus fan, and so I followed Jack one entire round. I followed Trevino. I remember following Cal Pete for several holes. He was fascinating because he just hit it dead straight.
Oh my God.
Every single time, dead straight. Like just not even it's not even legitimate. Somebody should do somebody's probably done an analysis of it. But I remember watching him just thinking, and he couldn't hit it. He didn't hit it very far, but it just went dead straight.
And he had a stranger move than Jim Furyk. I mean,
very unusual. Swing, and it was all because he'd broken his arm as a child, and his arm was kind of crooked, and so I loved watching him. I loved Trevino. I watched Trevino was great. He, you know, that you know we're and again I'm going to sound like an old guy here, but we're missing people in the game like Trevino and Cal Pete and just these characters, you know, Chi-Chi and people that can play all these different shots because you know. The guys don't play shots like that now. They hit it as far as they can, and then they hit it straight with a wedge or whatever. And, you know, so you just don't see people like Seve. And I mean, I don't know. Seve may have been the last, you know, even though he's gone, left the tour now, Mickelson was kind of that kind of player that played just whatever shot was there. He tried to play it, whether to his detriment a lot of times. But you just don't see that with the guys coming up now. They just don't. I mean, it's funny. I'm not even a good golfer, but I mean, I'll play with guys at Sweetens or somewhere that are scratch golfers, and I'll hit from 150 yards or something. I'll take an 8-iron and hit one that doesn't get more than 2 feet off the ground, and they'll look at me like I invented, like I've done something, and they're like, "What did you just do?" And I'm like, "Well, that's a run-up shot." I mean, and people don't. I don't know that it's, you know, they don't practice that kind of stuff that it's just it's just different, you know?
Yeah. You're right about
it's not, that's it. Sorry.
I remember, I don't know who it was. Somebody said, if he didn't know how to chip, he'd be selling cars in Arizona or something like
that. That somebody said that. I think Johnny Miller said that about Mickelson.
That's right.
Which, you know, one of the greatest short games ever, you know, along with Seve and, Tom Watson and you know that's the beauty of golf is there's different ways there you know there's not as many different ways now. I mean, you look at the way that people play now, and at least on tour, and it's just there's a lot of monotony to it. And I mean, I just look, the debate can people debate it all the time is you know, but you know, when you I think back to when guys would play a lot of different shots, and that's what I, and that's why I still like, I still love watching the Open. Is you get to see some of that, and I think the guys that struggle in those kind of conditions and stuff, they aren't able to, they've never played those kind of shots, and they're not able to adapt to it. So anyway.
And a guy like Bernhard can still move it around Augusta, you know, with the young guys. So
he can, and he's fascinating to watch. You know, I played with, since you mentioned Langer, I actually played with a German golfer called Pauli Mack, who's on the LPGA
tour
now.
Yeah.
And she hit the ball so far. She hit it further than virtually, it reminded me of when I used to watch Jordan play with the guys he played with. That's how far she hit it. And, you know, I think the women are coming around to where they're going to be, they're hitting it almost as, some of them are hitting it as far as the men do. I mean, she hit it so far that I couldn't believe it. And so I'm kind of become a fan of hers now. And I think she's just now gotten on the tour, but you know, Langer, been a fan of his since what was the year 84 or 85 where he got in contention at the Open.
Was it maybe 82? There was at Sandwich, right? When
And I hate that he seems like a guy that should have won the Open like five times. It doesn't make any sense.
But, well, he's won everything else since then, you know?
Exactly. And he's kind of inspirational. You know, I've been working on a story where I've been thinking about people like that, like Watson and at Turnberry when he was almost 60 years old. Or you guys might remember Nicklaus. Nicklaus, when he was 58, almost won the Masters. And that's another thing that's great about golf is, you know, there's always hope. And my dad, who's 79, still talks about how good he's hitting the ball, or you know, what he wants to work on. He just started going to some kind of trainer so he could work on his stretching out a little bit, so he could hit the ball a little bit further. I mean, to me, that's, for all of us, that's
the magic of it.
It never stops. That's what makes it great. I mean, there's no other sport like that. And you know, we all play
another sport with so much self-denial and passion. So, right, I've got another few interesting questions here along the line. Do you mind? Sometimes dream of golf, and if yes, are they good or bad dreams? Do you recall one, and would you care to share?
I've dreamed at times of remembering watching Jordan play all these tournaments, and they're generally happy. It'll be someplace where he had a good tournament, or that's probably the most. I do have a weird recurring dream that is, I don't know if any other golfers have run across this one, but where I'm on the first tee at a golf course, and I don't have enough room for my swing. I don't know what that is, but it's the most bizarre. I have that one, I don't know, occasionally. My back's, there's no, and I don't know what it is, whether it's I'm up against the clubhouse or, and that one is just bizarre. And it's always on the first tee of a golf course. And I don't know if that's,
it's a classic, Frank. Can you remember who it was?
I had that last night, that dream.
Oh, no, you didn't.
No, I have that all the time too. When I dream about golf, I dream about that.
I think
Crenshaw
said something very similar to
the tee somewhere.
Yeah, Crenshaw said something very similar that he couldn't. He. There was always something in his swing path or something. I think it was Crenshaw who had it, exactly your dream. So it must be something that's deeply rooted into the game, you know, instructed in any way.
It is. And the other part of that is not every time I have had that one, but a lot of the times there's a lot of people around the first tee, and it's almost like it's a a tournament or something, and you can't, and you just can't swing, and it's just like, what am I going to do? And then you wake up.
Am I here?
You know, it's you know, it's one of those things. You know, you get a lot of your anxiety comes out. But when I've had the dreams, you know, watching Jordan play, those are happy, and it's taken a while to have some of those. I mean, but yeah, that dream of the first tee is just, I don't know what that is, but that happens to me quite often. So,
all right, let's go from dreams to the real life. What's the most horrendous thing that has ever happened to you on a golf course?
That is a hard question. You know, not much bad has happened. I will say, one time I got into, I was up at Sweetens Cove 5 or 6 years ago. And I was looking for a golf ball along the edge of the water, and there was kind of some bushes and so forth. And I saw the ball, and I went down through these bushes to get it. And I don't know if you guys have poison ivy in Germany or not, but I just went straight through poison ivy. It got on almost every part of my body, and it was so bad that I really thought I was going to have to go to the hospital. That it was on my legs, my arms, my neck. I apparently just went straight through it trying to get this stupid golf ball.
Did you finish your round?
I did finish, because you know it takes a day or two for it to start.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's like an allergic reaction to this stuff.
Right. I thought it was a quicker thing.
No. It takes it. So like a day later, you just start breaking out with all this stuff. And I mean, it was the worst. I must have just like rubbed the stuff all over me. But it took me about 2 weeks to get over it.
Some very quick questions here. We're coming to the end of this. music on the range.
Music. I like listening to music when I play. We at Sweetens, we almost all of us, and I know everybody doesn't like that, but the last time I was up there, somebody had the two guys I was playing with had a David Bowie playlist that we listened to all day. And it was just on an endless loop. And yeah, you know, so we generally, almost all the guys I play with listen to music when we play up there. And I know some
That's
people,
cool.
Well, I know some people don't care for it, but now I don't think I honestly, this may seem like a strange response, but I'm not sure I would do it in Scotland. I've never done it in Scotland. But I've done it a ton in the US. So I don't know, but I generally at Sweetens, I enjoy the music going. So
I just couldn't imagine teeing off at Pamir with the boombox of my son blasting from his backpack.
No, I don't think it would work there. But I don't know. I mean, it's never crossed my mind when I've been over in the UK. But I don't know that every time we play at Sweetens, somebody's got music playing. So.
All right, match play or stroke play? You've already answered that one, I believe.
Match play, yeah.
Walk or ride?
Walk. Although I will say that Tennessee and Alabama in the summer,
warm,
when
isn't
it's 100, you have to ride summer. You just won't play because you'll kill yourself. But like this time of year and spring and fall, I love to walk, and I encourage people to walk. But you're an idiot if you try to walk around here in June, July, August, first part of September, unless you just want to got a death wish of some kind.
So. There's a nice story in the book about you in a cart in Scotland.
Oh yeah, I remember that one.
Well,
you almost embarrassed.
I was embarrassed.
Yeah, it sounded really embarrassed. Yeah,
it was a good story because I'd never ridden a cart. Obviously, they're not encouraged. They're not really prevalent, but
they're not common. Yeah,
they're not common. But I had gotten had that day I'd played already, and I got to this course called Rosse, which I loved, but The first hole, I walked up and I was looking, and the first hole was straight. I mean, guys, straight uphill, like just vertical. And I thought, I was already tired, and I saw a cart, a buggy sitting there, and I walked into the pro shop and I said, "Is there, the lady was extremely nice, and I said, "Is there any way you could let me have that buggy? I just don't think I can get around." And she goes, "Oh, we're having, it's already spoken for." And anyway, I was kind of killing some time in there, and she said, "Wait, somebody canceled." Anyway, she let me have it, and I was kind of embarrassed, but I have to say, that particular afternoon, I don't think I would have gotten around that course. There were so many holes that were straight uphill, and I loved it, and I'm glad I did it because I got to see the place that I probably would have just gone back to the hotel and gone to bed if I that afternoon. But I do look. I walk every time I can, and I believe that that's a good part of the game. But I also believe that you shouldn't. You're trying to have a good time, so you don't want to kill yourself. I mean, there's people at Sweetens in the summer. At least two or three times a summer, they have to call an ambulance
The
because
ambulance
to
in.
get people because if people try to walk and they pass out,
Next one. Do you warm up or not?
I don't know.
What's a gimme? Do you believe in giving them?
I do, but I also see the other side of it too. I believe, especially in match play, I think it's part of the fun of match play is when to give a putt, when not to give a putt. So I do believe that that's part of it.
Right. Do you know what a mulligan is, and do you take one occasionally?
I know what one is, but I generally don't.
Know what it is, you've never had one.
I've done it. I mean, and a lot of the, you'll see in the book, I mean, I played a lot of the rounds by myself and, and a lot of times I'd be the only guy on the course. So if I had a par three that I really liked, I
Play it
remember I
three
was
or
up,
four times.
I play, oh yeah. I mean, I
Yeah,
remember
yeah.
up at Durness, I think it was give me a minute, but I think it was the seventh hole at Durness. I must have hit 10 golf balls into that. There was nobody there. And so, yeah, I think from that side standpoint, I'll do it. Yeah.
We can skip the next one because it's Parkland or links, and I know you're a links maniac. So,
Yep.
driver or putter?
Putter, just because I love putters and there's just so many different designs and I've got a whole bag full of them here in my office and drivers are kind of a dime a dozen as far as I'm concerned. But putters, I'd say putter.
Personality and all that.
Yeah.
All right, okay. Have you got a lab putter? You
What kind of?
know lab, LAB?
I
We
don't.
had Sam Hahn, the CEO of Lab Putters, with us 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago. Correct me if I'm wrong, Frank. That was a great show. Really interesting guy. Center weighted stuff like that. Really
I'll have to
interesting.
check that out.
Yeah,
Yeah,
please do.
I've got I've got Bednardi and Scotty Cameron and just about every else other thing you can think of.
Yeah,
And
you're a classic. Yeah,
yeah,
you
great
got
guy.
hickory sticks.
I do enjoy those. I have a set, and I actually took them last year when I went over to Scotland. I took a partial set, and I played probably three or four rounds that way and had a lot of fun. So I do enjoy that and on the right kind of course. I mean, I don't, it's hard. I mean, it's definitely different, but if you get on the right kind of course with it, I think it's fun.
All
Okay, last one from me. What's the hardest course you've ever played on?
This is such a good question. I'm probably going to have to say, even though it's probably a standard answer, I Carnoustie is hard. And the four or five times I've played it, it's always been, I don't think I've ever played it on a calm day. I know I haven't. So there with the conditions, it's really different. Dornoch is very hard, I think. Dornoch is, I would put Dornoch right behind Carnoustie. I love Dornoch, but it's, Dornoch in the wind is so hard.
You can't really expect to score well in Dornoch, can you?
No, you just forget about that.
Yeah.
I don't even enjoy being out there. Enjoy the shots that you're going to hit. I mean, that course is so hard. I mean, they could have the open there with such ease if it was in the right, the right.
Yeah, it's just not the right logistics there.
Yeah.
Well, so that was the quick nine. Thank you very much, Jim.
Okay. I hope I didn't make the quick nine too long.
Everyone makes the quick nine too long. Trust me, nobody's short.
It's all about the answers.
Maybe we need to refine the questions too.
No, that was a lot of fun. I especially enjoyed the music questions.
Yeah, there you go. And also some excellent. Finally, the Doors. But you talk about in the book also about how you walked out at Carnoustie to where Jean van der Velde hit that shot from into the. Into the water, and Mark actually recreated that on film for I don't know who, some tourist society or something like that.
That was 2018. Yeah, and I climbed. I was with Alan Tate, the record holder for 21 years before Tommy Fleetwood broke it, and he had me climb into the burn there. And
well,
that was interesting.
We were, we were on a playing Panmure that day, but we had some time to kill, and we went over to Carnoustie, and they were set up for the women's open. The grandstands and everything were out, and we sat there with our coffee for about 30 minutes, and there was nobody. We hadn't seen anybody on the golf course, and I told Robbie, I said, I've got to walk out there where Vandeveld, where all this stuff happened with Vandeveld. And he's like, well, let's go. And nobody stopped us. And we walked out there and, you can sort of see the part in the burn. I just, he didn't play it, although he thought about playing it, but the shot before that, I don't know. People lose their head in certain situations. I mean, I remember watching that when it happened thinking, what in the world is this man doing? I mean, he hits his drive, which should have been gone, and he gets a perfect lie. And so I guess at that point he's like, okay, what, nothing can happen now. I mean,
I'm invincible.
I've hit this drive 80 yards right, and I'm sitting here teed up like a, so what difference does it make? And in fairness to him, the second shot, if it doesn't hit the railing on the grandstand, he probably wins easily. But yeah, I that is such a dramatic course for the Open. The finish there is so good, and it's a great Open course. I enjoyed doing that because we stood there for about 15 minutes and talked about, well, what if he did this or what if he did that? And I don't know. I feel sorry for the man all these years later, but it's in some ways he's probably become more legendary for what happened,
and he has made his peak. It's yeah. Interesting that Frank, that you bring this up, because Carnoustie is a course for the unlikely champion. It is a course, it is a course for the persistent, for the patient, for the guys with their head on their shoulders. You can't be too brash. You can't make mistakes. You plot your way through it. I thought it. I was there the last time they played it, and 2018, when Molinari won it. Yeah, and that was weird. That was really wild. Yeah.
Well, there's a course. They've got a course called the Burnside course there.
Yeah, lovely really, place.
I love the Burnside. I mean, to me, it's more fun. I mean, Carnoustie's a championship course, and I'm glad I've played it. And it's, I think the Open should continue to go there, and it's a great little town, and the people love golf, and but yeah, it's the winners, Hogan and Watson and Yeah, just some of the people that have won there. It's it brings out, as you say, somebody that is patient. And even when Paul Laurie, what was Paul Laurie 10 back or something when the day started, and he just kind of played his round, and so yeah, it's but that one in Dornicker,
yeah,
those are two of the harder courses. Yeah,
how about in the States, Jim? The hardest in the States.
Trying to think of the places I've played. I'll tell you, of course, I've played a lot. It's funny you mentioned it earlier. Shoal Creek is a very difficult golf course. And I've been lucky to play there several times. It's not but about an hour from where I live. And but the rough there, like I got to play it a few weeks ago in a tournament. And if you got out of the fairway, that Bermuda rough, the ball just sinks right down to the bottom, and you really can't do anything but get a wedge and kind of hack it out. Mm-hmm. And this is like the way they normally have it set up for the member. So I'd say, Shoal Creek is hard. I got to, that would probably be of the ones I've played, probably one of the more difficult.
There you go. Mr. Horner, what say you?
I'm inclined, gentlemen, to basically call it a wrap for today. It's
we do need to mention
well, if we could mention the
back nine press.
Oh yes, of course. I'm sorry, but
that's all right.
we do have a certain ritual to wrap up the show. We wouldn't be running off.
Jim's publisher, Back Nine Press, has issued a discount code for when Revelation comes. The code is Golfschau, spelled as a German way, Schau 20. So
have to look that one up.
Yeah, please. We're gonna throw it out there on our channels as well. Well, I don't know how long it's gonna be good for, but I'm guessing a couple of days.
It'll be good until April the 1st, and it's let's see, Back Nine Press, the number nine, backninepress.com.
Right. Backninepress.com.
It's the book is also available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble, but if you want the best edition, the first edition, I get it directly from Back Nine Press. So.
There you go. Well, it is a spectacular
book. Are we allowed to share this? Are we allowed to share this in social media, or is this something
I think we're supposed to.
Our listeners are allowed to get?
It's supposed to be for the listeners, if that's okay. Yeah.
Well, okay. So we'll start posting. Listen until the end and get your surprise.
Get your code. But, this book, Jim, and I said it to you at the very beginning, and you said it. I mean, it has a tragic and sad underlying story. But when I was reading it, the way you wrote it, you made me forget about that. And then you came back to it.
Thank you for saying that, because I do want to, before we end up, I mean, the book, I want people to laugh, and I want people to enjoy it, and I want people to take something from it. I mean, there's a lot of different, I've heard from so many different people that have children, don't have children. Their father may have just died, or a parent may have just died, and they talk about how this book helped them. But then they also talk about just laughing out loud about something, and that makes me feel good, because I do not want it to be it has a story that I wanted to tell, but it's a lot more than that, and I think most people that have read it have kind of echoed what you said, which makes me feel good, because that was the intention when I started writing it.
It is, I believe, a tremendous love letter to the game and to life, and that's how I read it. All the pain that's in the center, you can't put it aside. But maybe no. But it is a fantastic love letter, and thank you very much, because it did make for excellent reading, and
great lot of laughs, and for great memories that you reactivated, because I love a lot of the places that you describe there.
Well, I've heard from so many people, and just people that want to take the exact same trip, and you know, ask me for advice on that, or people that may have lost a loved one, or people that have kids and just say, you know, I need to change, I need to take advantage of, you know, this time and not waste it. And so, you know, it's a book about life, really. And that's one reason I want to do you guys' podcast. And I really appreciate you having me on, because the reaction, honest, quite frankly, from around the world has really been better than almost better than the reaction in the U.S. I mean, I've heard from so many people that have gotten the book in the UK and just other countries, Australia and hopefully Germany now too. It's a story that I think resonates regardless of where you're from. And so anyway, thank you guys for letting me come on to talk about it. I really enjoyed it.
No, thank you. And just a couple of the examples that made me laugh out loud. I mean, there's one scene where you and I believe your friend Robbie are sitting, and the green fee is like 20 pounds, or you can join the club for 60, and you're like, ah, oh, fuck it, I'm joining the club.
Well, yeah. you know, I didn't, that's the only...
Collinsy, isn't it?
It's a Collinsy, yeah. It's the only time I used to... language of that nature in the entire book, but I thought it was appropriate. Yeah.
It was appropriate.
And I did join, and I love places like that. And my point was, you know, okay, 10 pounds or 60. And if 60 helps them take care of the golf course a little bit more or whatever they need, I'm so happy to do it. And, you know, places like that deserve to exist, and that's the way I look at it. So,
and I thought it was quite brilliant that they ran out of duck at the Ducks Inn. I mean, how funny is that?
Yep.
I mean, how far?
And we were just so exhausted, and just when I heard, I was sitting there listening to these guys at the next table, and when I heard the waitress say that, I almost spit my drink. I just thought, oh, this is hilarious. These guys, they've been sitting there studying the menu, and they finally wanted this one thing, and it was the one thing they did not have, which was duck at the Ducks Inn. So, and Malcolm would appreciate that, who's a great guy. And that, you know, I encourage anybody who's traveling in the Gullen, East Lothian area to stay at that hotel, because it's, you know, it's one of the great golf hotels of the world. So.
Well, we're going to beat the drum for this spectacular book. Jim, thank you for being here. Thank you for writing this book. I just like Mark said, it's one of his favorites from last year, and I can't remember reading a book with so much pleasure it really grabbed me. I think we started off with the Syd Barrett quote. And there's another quote that you use in your book for the acknowledgments. Another one of my favorite guys, Graham Parsons. And it goes like this. And I remember something you once told me, and I'll be damned if it did not come true. 20,000 roads I went down, 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 and they all lead me straight back home to you. Yep. Grievous Angel.
Return of the Grievous Angel, the great Graham Parsons. I mean, you know, listen to some of his lyrics, and he's another guy like Sid that was a genius and was not able to handle. I think sometimes people are too sensitive for the world, and people like Sid and Graham, you know, I have a affinity to, and I'm glad you pointed that one out, because I you know, I know this isn't a music podcast, but anybody that's never listened to Graham Parsons, I encourage you to go back and get. He only had a couple of albums, and he was in the Birds for a while. But anyway, yes, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's one of the best country albums out there.
Yeah, it is.
The Return of the Grievous Angel. Mr. Hartzell, thank you very much, sir. Give our best to Alabama and to your lovely family, and thank you for stopping by.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
There you go. My name is Frank Forster.
My name is Mark Hoganer. To the Linkfluent.
To the Linkfluent.